94.1 in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 11th, 2015. This is Up Front. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert on today's show.
We don't have a declaration in statute, but we have absolutely the same authority. We're going forward. The only thing different is my zeal has been intensified to a maximum degree, and nothing is going to stop this state from pushing forward.
After a major climate bill loses its teeth, Governor Brown says he's ready to go it alone. So what would that actually look like? We'll discuss climate policy and the changing balance of power in the Capitol. Then, California's massive pension funds are struggling to maintain their funding levels, and critics are starting to point the finger at the state's increasing reliance on private equity firms. Eve Smith of Naked Capitalism will join us to talk about why she thinks one of the world's biggest institutional investors is getting fleeced. It's all next this hour, after the news.
I'm Cameron Jones with KPFA News Headlines. The House is continuing to flex its muscles on the Iran nuclear deal, even though the Senate has already sealed its fate in Congress. Senate Democrats voted on Thursday to uphold the accord with Iran, overcoming heavy GOP opposition. House Republicans will continue today to further 11th-hour strategies to derail the agreement, and Senate Republicans are promising a revote. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
We'll revisit the issue next week and see if maybe any folks want to change their minds and give us a chance to remove the procedural roadblock.
Conservative Republicans are vowing to take President Barack Obama to court, claiming he's broken the law by not providing Congress with all relevant documents pertinent to the deal. Vice President Joe Biden described himself Thursday as overwhelmed at times by his son's death and unconvinced he could commit fully to being president.
I'd be lying if I said that I knew I was there.
In an emotional interview that cast a deep pall over his deliberations about the 2016 presidential race, Biden reiterated doubts about whether he and his family have the emotional energy to run.
I don't think any man or woman should run for president unless, number one, they know exactly why they would want to be president, and two, they can look at the folks out there and say, I promise you, you have my whole heart, my whole soul, my energy, and my passion to do this.
Joe Biden's son, Beau, died from brain cancer in May. The vice president's blunt description of his own emotional frailty on Thursday marked the strongest indication yet that he may be leaning against running for the Democratic nomination. Hundreds of San Francisco residents and housing activists protested inside City Hall yesterday, visiting the offices of every city supervisor, asking for their support for legislation that would stop thousands of evictions in the city. Maria Zamudio is with Casa Justa Just Cause. She says frustration has been building in vulnerable communities of color in San Francisco.
It's really easy for speculators and landlords and market rate developers to come into our neighborhoods and buy our lands, buy our homes for very cheaply, flip them, evict us, and make a lot of money. So I think that's one of the reasons why working class people of color are, and it's Latinos, it's Filipinos, it's African Americans, it's Chinese folks, we're all getting hit incredibly hard by this crisis.
Known as the Eviction Protection Act Just Cause 2.0, the ordinance was proposed by Supervisor Jane Kim and would discourage evictions in San Francisco by not allowing rent increases and prevent landlords from evicting tenants in order to raise the rent. San Francisco resident Daro Romero says activists are seeking support from supervisors to move the legislation forward.
It's called Just Gas Eviction 2.0. It's a more stronger measures to prevent displacement and evictions in San Francisco. We want that from the three supervisors in the Land Use Committee approve it to pass it to the full board. And we think that if they approve this stronger regulation to prevent evictions, we have more people in the houses now.
Housing activists will hold another action this Monday when the Land Use Committee will discuss the ordinance, one of the strongest ever proposed in San Francisco to prevent evictions. Cuba's highest authority says it is releasing more than 3,500 prisoners ahead of next week's visit to the island by Pope Francis, the third time Cuba has granted inmates freedom before a papal visit. The Council of State announced this morning that the prisoners to be freed include a mix of women, people younger than 20, inmates suffering from illnesses, and people whose terms were coming to an end next year. In New York, a private service at Ground Zero for family members of the victims of the September 11, 2001 attacks. Thousands are expected later to reflect on the September 11 attacks 14 years ago today that killed nearly 3,000 people. There are other observances around the country. Chile is also remembering this day for a different reason. On September 11, 1973, Chile's socialist president Salvador Allende was deposed in a coup. The overthrow ushered in the military dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet, who ruled the country with an iron fist for more than 15 years. The CIA has since admitted knowledge of the plot to overthrow Allende. Declassified documents reveal how the Nixon administration instructed the agency to subvert the Allende administration and to, quote, make the economy scream, end quote. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, mostly sunny skies this morning, becoming clear later, cooler later today, with highs in the low 80s, upper 90s, and low triple digits well inland. And in Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny and hot with a high of 103 degrees. I'm Cameron Jones. More news at 7:30.
7:07 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert, and we're going to be spending all of this hour covering the state capitol, starting with a legislative session that is barreling toward a close at 12 o'clock tonight. The biggest development this week was that a major piece of climate change legislation that had been pending, it had gotten through the Senate and it was awaiting approval in the Assembly and facing an advertising and lobbying onslaught by the oil industry. This is Senate Bill 350, whose most controversial proposal was that it would require the state of California to set a goal of reducing petroleum consumption on state-controlled roads by 50%. Well, that basically went down in flames. Its sponsor, Senate Leader Darren DeLeon, and Governor Brown apparently couldn't put together the votes to support it without making compromises that they thought would fatally compromise it. Apologies for the redundancy. And then we got a highly unusual press conference late on Wednesday, where Governor Jerry Brown basically came out swinging against the oil industry. An industry, we'll note later, he's not always had a hostile relationship with. Here's Christopher Martinez's report.
Governor Jerry Brown and legislative leaders have withdrawn a key part of a greenhouse gas reduction bill, but that's not putting any damper on their efforts to combat climate change. Governor Brown spoke to reporters at the state capitol Wednesday.
I'd say oil has won a skirmish, but they've lost the bigger battle, because I am more determined than ever to make our regulatory regime work for the people of California, cleaning up the air, reducing the petroleum, and creating the green jobs that are going to put hundreds of thousands of people to work over the coming decades.
At issue was a key part of Senate Bill 350, Senate President Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon's Clean Energy and Pollution Reduction Act. The measure aimed at putting into law goals of slashing petroleum use in vehicles by 50%, shifting half of electricity generation to renewable sources, and increasing building energy efficiency by 50%, all by the year 2030. Last month, hundreds of environmental justice activists rallied at the Capitol calling for climate policies that protect communities of color. Strela Servas is co-director of the California Environmental Justice Alliance. She said SB 350 is a top priority for the coalition.
This bill is incredibly important to California and especially to environmental justice communities because it's because the environmental justice communities are the ones that are living on the front lines of right next to dirty energy and power plants and oil refineries, and they are the ones that are demanding renewable energy, local renewable energy in their communities, and also the economic and jobs benefits.
The bill sparked a massive counterattack from the petroleum industry and some business groups, including multi-million dollar lobbying efforts by the Western States Petroleum Association, the California Chamber of Commerce, and Chevron. De Leon says with 2 days left in the legislative session, supporters of his bill could not cut through what he calls silly season scare tactics from an industry opposed to environmental progress.
I don't think we've ever seen. This is unprecedented. Tens of millions of dollars have spent to create this smokescreen inside the Capitol. This is unlike anything we've ever seen, period, hands down. So
the end result is that the provision on cutting petroleum use is being dropped from the bill in a bid to win votes from moderate Democratic assembly members. The other provisions on renewable energy and building efficiency will move forward in the amended bill. Democrat Tony Atkins is Speaker of the Assembly.
No one provision of a bill, as I think the governor pointed out, is really worth giving up the vital goals that we are putting forward in SB 350.
Even without the petroleum reduction, Senator De Leon says the bill will make California's best-in-the-nation air standards tougher. He had wanted the petroleum provision in order to put into law the governor's already announced goal on the subject. Governor Brown says that goal remains in place, and he turned down an attempt to weaken the Air Resources Board's power to act on that goal.
Now, what was the bill all about? The bill was about codifying in law the 50% goal. We still have the 50% goal. The California Air Resources Board has all the power that it's had, and it will continue to exercise that power, certainly as long as I'm governor.
The leaders say they'll continue moving forward on that goal, as well as other efforts to fight climate change, whether through legislation or through administrative action. Brown says at the end of the day, we have to decarbonize the economy.
California is not going to miss a beat. Be very clear about that. We don't have a declaration in statute, but we have absolutely the same authority. We're going forward. The only thing different is my zeal has been intensified to a maximum degree, and nothing is going to stop this state from pushing forward on our low carbon fuel standard and our cap and trade and our electric vehicle mandate and all the rest. We're not going the way other states where they can say, no, you jump through the hoops and then we'll give you a few crumbs. We're not taking the crumbs, we're not taking the bait, and California will continue to lead.
On the State Capitol Beat, I'm Christopher Martinez.
We're joined now by two people who know environmental politics in the Capitol better than pretty much anyone else. On the phone, we have Bill McGavern, who's Policy Director of the Coalition for Clean Air. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
And our second bill, Bill Alyot, California Director of Governmental Affairs at the Environmental Working Group. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be back on KFPA.
Or KPFA. Bill McGavern, I'd like to start with the... Well, let's call it the evisceration of Senate Bill 350 because it's still technically alive, but it doesn't have that petroleum-cutting mandate in it anymore. What do you make of the fact that Jerry Brown came out swinging against the oil industry on Wednesday night?
Well, first of all, Brian, I think we should make clear that a bill that had three very strong provisions in it now has two very strong provisions in it. So let's not lose sight of the fact that getting to over 50% renewable electricity and doubling our energy efficiency in buildings are very major goals that are still in the bill. But absolutely, it is sickening that the oil industry ran a completely sleazy, deceptive advertising campaign that resulted in the petroleum section being taken out of the bill. And I thought the governor's performance at the press conference was fantastic. And I loved it when he said that his zeal has been intensified to the maximum degree. So what that says to me is that he and his appointees will use the authority that they have under existing law to reduce our petroleum usage and to strive for that 50% reduction, whether it makes it into law or not.
What could they actually do? If you were appointed to head the Air Resources Board tomorrow, what could you do to cut gas use?
So the Air Resources Board has a number of tools, and they're essentially three ways that we can cut our use of gasoline and diesel and petroleum. One is to improve the engines that are in the vehicles, making them more efficient and also converting from the internal combustion engine to hybrids and plug-in hybrids and battery electric vehicles. The second is through the fuels, and the Air Board has a regulation called the Low Carbon Fuel Standard, which they're actually planning to strengthen in 2 weeks. And the third is by reducing the miles that our vehicles are traveling, by giving people more choices, better public transit, planning our communities better so that people don't have as long commutes, and that it is safer and more convenient to use bikes and just walking to get around. And these are all elements that are already in state policy and just need to be ratcheted up.
Bill Alliot, I want to talk about a different facet of the governor's relationship to the oil industry. He's been extraordinarily supportive of expanding oil drilling in the state and exploring for oil in the Monterey Shale Formation by hydrofracturing. In fact, we're learning more and more about what he did to make sure drilling permits got green-lighted. Why the sudden hostility towards the oil industry?
Well, this is very interesting. It's like a dichotomy. Here you have one of the planet's leaders on climate change, on the other hand, cheering on the oil industry and defending them over the last few years when it comes to fracking. And the regulatory agency that oversees fracking and the oil industry, the Division of Oil, Gas, Geothermal Resources, that everyone knows as Dogger. And it's been interesting to watch the kind of the evolution of Governor Brown since 2011, when it came to light that the state was not regulating fracking. And then when he fired the managers of the oil and gas program and the umbrella agency that oversees them for not getting permits out to the oil companies fast enough, and for actually trying to enforce the laws that were in existence at that time, setting aside fracking. They weren't regulating fracking, but in fact, when those regulators were fired, people came up to me, because I was working on fracking at the time, and said, is this because of fracking? I said, no, it's because the oil industries were breathing down Jerry Brown's neck about just permitting in general. So he's never said this is a state agency, you know, out of control or a lapdog to the agents, to the oil industries, as which they were. And it's a real different situation with the Air Board. He said at the press conference, the oil industries want us to turn over what the ARB, the Air Board, does to the legislature. And he said, no way we're going to do that. But the oil industries are not saying turn over what Dogger does to the legislature. They've liked what Dogger has done for them over the last 80, 90 years, which is give them everything they want. And we're in a new era, finally, reform of that state agency. And the governor, though, hasn't stepped forward and said that agency has been completely in the lap of the oil industry, and we need to reform it. Instead, he said, let science run its course. Let Dogger, you know, do its thing. On the other hand, to his credit, he has replaced managers there. I think we have a good team in place now to actually stand up to the oil industries and start to get the industry adequately regulated beyond fracking for how they dispose of waste and every other aspect of regulating the industry.
But there's a lawsuit live now by several Central Valley farmers who allege their well water was contaminated by wastewater from fracking permits that Dogger approved. And that lawsuit, among other things, basically argues that there was a quid pro quo between the oil industry and the Brown administration. It points out that he replaced managers for not approving drilling permits fast enough at Dogger, and then the oil industry contributed a combined $750,000 to the campaign committee he had set up to help push his major tax measure, Proposition 30, in 2012.
That's right. Well, the Los Angeles Times kind of tried to connect the dots between those campaign contributions and the firing of those regulators. It's clearly illegal if the governor did that. I'm not saying he did it, but someone think he did. The two lawsuits, one has actually been won already from oil wastewater polluting a farm. The second one's about the same issue. And to be clear, it's not about fracking polluting. It's, in these cases, it's been the disposal of all the wastewater created by oil drilling in general, of which a small part of which is flow back from these fracking operations. And so this is something we've been trying to point out for 4 years. It's not just that we weren't regulating fracking, it's that the agency dogger has done a very poor job of regulating the disposal of wastewater and even overseeing the basic day-to-day operations of the oil industry. And that's what Jerry Brown has never come out and said we have a problem about. It's like, let it run its course, we're fixing it. I think now he couldn't deny that Dogger has been a wreck, and he's doing something about it, but he's more preoccupied with climate change, as he should be, and hopefully we get the agency back into shape. Well, not back into shape. They've never been in shape. They haven't been defending the public and recognizing the protection of public resources. They've been basically facilitating oil drilling for the last 100 years, and that's changing now.
Bill McGavern, I want to get your sense of the political landscape. Is the oil industry's muscle changing in Sacramento? The state was able to pass sweeping climate change legislation under a Republican governor. It's first climate change bill, SB 32. The successor bill this year from Fan Pavley just got shot down this week. All it would have done is extended the goals for cuts for decades past the expiration of the current bill.
Well, the problem that we have now in the Capitol is we've always had this group of business Democrats that really their whole model is they take a lot of money from the big polluters like the oil companies, and then they try to kill or water down strong legislation that affects the interests of those companies. That group has now grown and become more powerful. And it's partly because of the change that was made to the Constitution that now elects our legislators through the top two system. So the oil companies now have two opportunities, both the primary and the general election, to try to dominate the process with their big contributions. And they did a lot of that in the last election cycle. Consequently, a lot of these business-oriented Democrats were elected to the Assembly, and that's the group that was essentially spouting the talking points of the oil lobbyists during the discussions over this petroleum section. And if you talk with people in the governor's office or the Senate pro tem's office, they say that really what they were hearing from the lobbyists for the Western States Petroleum Association was the same thing that they were hearing from these business Democrats. Let's weaken the Air Resources Board. Let's put loopholes into existing law to make it easier for oil companies to sue against these measures to beat back climate change.
Above and beyond the number of politicians that they can count on, is the oil industry changing the amount of money they're putting into advertising, into lobbying, into actually campaigning around California legislative sessions?
Well, they're clearly investing a huge amount of money into the lobbying and into the outright lies that they told in their ads. Because of how slow our disclosure rules work, we don't know yet how much they've spent on the advertising. I've heard that maybe it did not reach $10 million, but we don't know yet. They will have to eventually disclose that. But clearly, they have huge amounts of profits, and it's worth it to them to invest a really small percentage of those profits into trying to distort our political process and our legislative process.
In terms of the oil lobby in California, is it worth distinguishing between companies that make money sucking oil out of the ground here and companies that make money refining oil and selling it to California consumers? Do they have divergent interests at all?
Sometimes they do. In this situation, I don't think there's any significant divergence, and I think most of the money and the decisions are coming from the huge multinational companies like Chevron and British Petroleum and Shell they're the ones that are really calling the shots on the California lobbying and lying operation.
And most of them, if my, I might add, are drilling in California and also have refineries in L.A., San Francisco, or Kern County area. I want to say on the quarterly expenditures, the Western States Petroleum Association is usually the leader in California politics every quarter for the amount they spend, and they often get what they want. This year, they killed all of the Dogger reform bills, bills that would have put more teeth in the agency or put side rails on them to force them to do a better job. The oil companies were very successful this year. They were all were dead by the time we reached the end of the session, including Senator Pavley's bill, which was alive up until about 4 or 5 weeks ago. So they cleared the decks and were able to fight just on Senate Bill 350 and 32, using all the power and influence they have in the Capitol, which, as Mr. McGavern points out, is great, especially with the moderate Democrats.
Dogger is the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, and even without further legislation, it has the power to deny any oil company a permit to dispose of its wastewater, or a permit to drill in the first place. What more actually, why do you need more legislation?
They have broad authorities, and but they've evolved over. This is their 100-year anniversary, actually, from 1915 to 2015. They've evolved. They have field rules, regulations, and laws, and they're fairly broadly stated in most cases. And the way they've interpreted them and used them in the field has been kind of, hey, Joe, what do you need today? Especially in Kern County, we had anonymous staffers report that things were really bad, especially in Kern County, and that's been exposed over the last few years. It was true, and slowly reform is occurring. The new supervisor of Dogger says he is into reforming the agency, and he's let some people go. Some of the good old boys, that we call them, have retired. They have done some good regulations. We think we have the best fracking regulations in the United States. But there's still work to be done. When I started working on this issue almost five years ago, I had a list on my wall of things that needed to be fixed at Dogger. Number one was get fracking regulated, because we knew there weren't votes in the legislature and Jerry Brown was not going to put a moratorium or ban on. We had to make sure that as the industry did these jobs, that they were doing it correctly and safely and not polluting water and the air. And we couldn't assure the public that was happening. So that was priority one, is to get the regulatory regime in order. And that's being done, and it's still being done. But on wastewater and location of wells next to schools and sensitive areas, that's still stuff that needs to be worked on. And the oil companies kind of bogged that work down. They have so much money, as Bill said, that they can work on many fronts at once while we're trying to do, you know, A, B, C. They've got A through Z covered.
All right. Bill Alliot, Bill McGavern, that's all the time we have. I want to thank you both so much for speaking with us this morning.
Thank you, Brian.
You're welcome. Thanks.
The last voice you heard was Bill Alliot. He is California Director of Governmental Affairs for the Environmental Working Group. Before him, Bill McGavern, Policy Director of the Coalition for Clean Air. The regular legislative session in Sacramento officially ends at midnight tonight. However, the special legislative session dealing with health and transportation, which has achieved, I think, exactly zero of the goals that it was convened with the goal of achieving, can be extended further in the year and likely will be. It is just past 7:28 in the morning, and I want to let you know about a few things we have coming up. KPFA has an amazing series of author book talks set for this fall's book season. On September 17th, we will have on the stage Laura Nader, hosted by our own Richard Walensky, presenting a new book called What the Rest Think of the West, 600 AD. That'll be at the Hillside Club in Berkeley. September 26th, an amazing new author named Dee Watkins. I just taped an interview with him. We're going to be broadcasting it Monday. His new book is The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. And that's at the First Congregational Church of Oakland. And on September 29th, Phyllis Bennett, who's going to be hosted by Mitch Jeserich, on her new book, Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, also at Berkeley's Hillside Club. All of our events start at 7:30 in the evening. All of them have room for questions from the audience. We'd love to see you there. It's a fantastic way to support KPFA and to support people who are producing amazing books. You can get tickets in advance at brownpapertickets.com or local independent booksellers, and full details on our website, kpfa.org/events. Now, one other piece of business is that starting on Tuesday, we're going to have our first fund drive in quite some time. You will recall that we managed to call off our summer fund drive, something we were very excited about, and that was on the tail of slimming down our spring fund drive. And now we're going to try to raise a whole lot of money in a very short period of time, starting on Tuesday. So two requests I would like to plant in your head. One, the first time you hear us ask for money, be as generous as you can, and you have our promise that we will keep the fund drive as short as we can. Second, if you have any time free, think about putting in some time in our phone room to help us answer calls. Phone room opens at 6:30 a.m. every morning, starting Tuesday morning. It takes about 5 minutes to get trained if you've never answered phones before. It's a great way to see your radio station from the inside. We're at 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in downtown Berkeley, and there's directions on how to get here on our website, kpfa.org. Well, now it's 7:30 in the morning. The program is up front. Station is KPFA 94.1. My name's Brian Edwards-Tiegert. And when we return, we're going to stay on state politics, but look at the hundreds of billions of dollars that are managed by the two major retirement funds controlled by the state of California, CalPERS and CalSTRS. Eve Smith at Naked Capitalism has been digging into how they manage their portfolio of investments in shadowy private equity firms. Come to the conclusion that the state may be getting fleeced. Is your retirement on the line? We'll take your questions next, after the news.
I'm Cameron Jones with KPFA News Headlines. Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake will not seek re-election, the Baltimore Sun reported today. Rawlings Blake will make an announcement at 10 a.m. local time. She's stepping down to focus on the upcoming trials facing the six police officers involved in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. A California appeals court has rejected the Pasadena Police Union's efforts to block the release of a report into officers' fatal shooting of an unarmed teenager. The court says the report is public record. The court also found redactions ordered by a trial court went too far. Black unarmed 19-year-old Kendrick McDade was shot and killed by two white Pasadena police officers 3 years ago. The officers say they believe McDade was armed based on false information from a 911 caller. One officer said McDade was reaching for his waistband as they pursued him. The city of Pasadena paid $1 million to settle a wrongful death suit brought by McDade's parents. The San Francisco jail is taking steps to house female trans inmates based on their gender identity. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that Sheriff Ross Mircarimi says that beginning next month, inmates and staff members will be educated and trained to make for a smooth transition for transgender inmates to participate with other women in drug and alcohol abuse education programs and women's empowerment groups. The sheriff's department currently houses transgender inmates in their own unit for their protection. Mercurimi says few transgender men are generally in the jails. The sheriff's department prioritized integration protocols for transgender women. Hundreds of thousands of people began massing in the streets of Barcelona to call for Catalonia to break away from Spain. The action comes 2 weeks before a regional election that many see as a make-or-break moment for the independence movement. While polls suggest 80% of Catalans are in favor of secession, a separatist victory would be highly unlikely to translate into outright secession. A symbolic referendum on independence last year attracted only two-fifths of the 5.5 million Catalan voters. And weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area. Mostly sunny skies this morning, becoming clear later. Cooler today with highs in the low 80s. Upper 90s and low triple digits well inland. And in Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny and hot with a high of 103 degrees. I'm Cameron Jones. More news at 8 o'clock.
7:34 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards Tiegert. California has two large publicly controlled funds that are devoted to paying for the retirements of some 2.4 million teachers and public employees. They are the California State Employee Retirement System, CalSTRS, and the California Public Employee Retirement System, CalPERS. Between the two of them, they manage almost $500 billion. They manage so much money that when they announce that they are looking to buy a stock, the price of that stock jumps because they are such a large investor. But a large portion of their money does not move through the stock market. It does not move through places where it is particularly transparent. It moves through something you probably heard a lot of on this show during Mitt Romney's presidential run, the world of private equity. And these are firms that buy up control of companies, often take them off the stock market, and then have a large number of tools at their disposal for both avoiding taxes, reforming those companies, and pocketing vast amounts of wealth. Now, most of the coverage we've done of private equity up to this point has focused on its impact on the real economy, how companies that had been productive, that had employed a large number of people, could get kind of hollowed out in this process and run into the ground, all while making the investors that control them still pretty wealthy. The other side of the ledger is what happens to entities like CalPERS and CalSTRS. Do they actually get a good deal out of parking their money with outfits like the one that Mitt Romney used to work for? Well, the blog NakedCapitalism.org has been running this marvelous series looking at how CalPERS and CalSTRS are handling their investments in private equity. They've even gone to court to win the release of documents about those investments. We're joined now by the person writing that series, Eve Smith, founder of the blog Naked Capitalism and author of Econ: How Unenlightened Self-Interest Undermined Democracy and Corrupted Capitalism. Welcome.
Brian, thanks so much. Glad to be here.
So I want to give our listeners a flavor of what you've been doing. A lot of it is parsing up publicly available video from the meetings of the CalPERS Investment Committee, where you get some very odd interactions between the public officials who are on their oversight board and the staff who are managing the investments. Here is Dana Hollinger, a member of that board, questioning investment director Christine Gogan about whether they actually get to see the finances of the companies that the private equity firms they deal with purchase.
Have we ever seen the financials of those underlying companies or no? With respect to what's been occurring in the industry, is there's definitely been an evolution that's occurred over time. And I would say we are moving towards an environment where we are receiving the much more detailed information with respect to the underlying. But to make a broad statement, that we have always had access to the underlying detailed information in the portfolio companies is a stretch. It's definitely improving.
Translation, they don't let us see the books. Eve Smith, why did you start looking into private equity and California's retirement funds?
Well, I actually started, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, and in part it was because an insider came forward with information, and that's one of the symbols of why the coverage of this, what's problematic about this industry, has been so limited. The point that you made in the introduction, that this industry is shrouded in secrecy, that investors don't get basic information that you would think they should have in order to know whether the investments are sound. After they have provided the money to the private equity funds, they rely on reports from the fund managers as to how they are doing and don't have access to independent information as to what's really going on. I mean, there's a big, trust me element of this business. And what's become increasingly disturbing about it is that the private equity firms, all but really trivially sized ones, pretty much the entire industry, has now become subject to some level of supervision via the SEC. They're part of their business to supervise certain activities that are not, but they have now become they're now required to register as investment advisors. The result of that is that the SEC has started going in and just looking at basic stuff like, are these guys delivering on what their contracts are saying? Are they delivering on what their marketing materials, what they've implied to the investors in the marketing period? Are they acting like fiduciaries? You know, the SEC believes that these private equity funds have a fiduciary duty, even though, astonishingly, their contracts have language in them in which they try to waive fiduciary duty. And the SEC, about a bit more than a year ago, in May 2014, their head of examinations, Andrew Bowden, gave a speech that sort of stunned the private equity investors by basically saying that more than half of the industry was engaged in what amounted to stealing or other serious compliance violations. So here this trust they've placed in this industry that has shrouded itself in secrecy is very much misplaced. And the reason that I have taken some interest in the investor side, even though that's, you know, again to your point in the introduction, is, you know, sort of would appear to be less obviously problematic, is in fact it is problematic, and that, you know, until people start questioning the whole reason why they're investing in private equity, the industry is going to continue to flourish and continue to do the sort of societal damage that you were talking about. Their strategies are based on leverage. You know, a top tax expert, Lee Shepard, described private equity as a tax scheme with an acquisition attached, and it's the use of leverage that boosts their returns. And also,
by leverage, you mean
borrowing.
Borrowing typically against the value of the companies they're buying.
That's correct. So they'll buy a company. They'll typically only, you know, the average number is only 30%. Typically 70% is borrowed money, the industry also used to only buy really stable companies in terms of the cash flow they generated. You know, recently they were big in oil and gas, and that's an incredibly volatile, capital-intensive industry. And you know, those deals are now hitting the wall. You know, they've just gone way beyond the kind of their sort of traditional formula as they've gotten bigger and bigger. And you know, and the deals continue to use a lot of leverage. And you know, the risks of bankruptcy remain high.
So it's the core question here is: it is hard to imagine a more sophisticated investor than CalPERS or CalSTRS. They have a tremendous amount of leverage with $500 billion in assets under management. You would think they could pretty much set terms with the firms they deal with, and they can support a large staff to provide oversight of their investments. So how is it actually working when they go into business with private equity?
That's a very good question, and that's what's so disturbing about what we're seeing out of CalPERS and CalSTRS is, you know, basically if they're having trouble getting a square deal out of these firms, and if they're having trouble with oversight, imagine what it's like, you know, with all the other investors in private equity who don't have their sophistication and don't have their depth of staff. What you've seen in these videos is, in these interactions with the board is basically there's been one board member, J.J. Jelencic, who's only asked fairly basic questions, and the staff goes on tilt. You know, they stonewall, or they don't know the answers to questions. And this is a reflection of the fact that the investors really don't negotiate these deals. And to your point about transparency, they really don't get much information. The contracts, despite the fact that you would think the investors have a lot of clout, they are presented with what amount to take-it-or-leave-it contracts. They typically only a very few terms are negotiated. And one of the big problems that investors like CalPERS and CalSTRS have is that on every front, they find it well nigh impossible to get decent independent advice. The private equity industry throws around so much money in fees, particularly legal fees, and fees to Wall Street. They're the biggest single source of income to Wall Street on the investment banking side, that no law firm wants to be on the other side, even if they don't have a narrow conflict, you know, that when, you know, say CalPERS hires a law firm to negotiate a deal by Bain, which was Romney's old firm, you know, and the law firm they hire doesn't represent Bain. Trust me, they're either representing other private equity firms or they want to represent private equity in a bigger way. So they're not going to break the rice bowl. They're not going to challenge the structure or the fund, you know, the tricks that are embedded in these very complicated, legally dense deals. I mean, I've looked at a few of them, and, you know, you'll look at one section, and it's incredibly hard to parse just because, you know, literally it will refer to definitions in seven other places, definitions or sections in seven other places in the document. These are designed to be very difficult to read, even if you regularly read legal documents.
Speaking of Eve Smith, founder of the blog Naked Capitalism, author of a series on the involvement of CalPERS and CalSTRS with private equity firms, also author of a book called Econ, How Unenlightened Self-Interest Undermined Democracy and Corrupted Capitalism. And if you're one of the 2.4 million people in California who are counting on those systems for your retirement and you have a question about how they're operating, we'd love your call, 1-800-958-9008. Eve Smith, from a bird's eye view, everything you raised, the lack of transparency, potentially outrageous fees, negative impacts on the real economy. If you're a fiduciary at CalPERS, you could argue that those are all moot as long as the returns are good, as long as you're going to be able to cover your members' retirement. So is that working out?
Well, that's another issue. I mean, the CalPERS continues, you know, one of the sections, and it's a little too dense, you know, to go into in the show, but there's one section where the chief investment officer basically gives the industry party line, which is, oh, we need to be, effectively, it's, oh, we need to be in private equity because it's the only strategy that offers returns that beat our overall portfolio requirements. Well, First thing, private equity relies on a measurement called internal rate of return, which that's not the basis on which any other of CalPERS investments are measured. And that measurement is notorious among finance people as making mediocre investments look good and good investments look terrific. And it's particularly flattering to investments that have the cash flow pattern of private equity, where you get a lot, where you get, you know, sort of high return payouts first and lower return payouts second. Private equity tends to be able to sell, typically in private equity, the deals that return best are the ones that you flip fairly quickly. And then the dogs in the portfolio hang around and get sold, you know, sort of much later. That pattern is really goosed by the use of that measurement internal rate of return, which is also called IRR. So even using this flawed metric, CalPERS private equity is not meeting its benchmarks. Private equity is riskier. The reason it in theory could return more is that it is also riskier than other strategies, again, because it uses borrowing. Borrowing makes your returns higher in a good market. It makes them worse in a bad market. Everybody understands that. And so they require a premium for private equity to reflect the leverage and the fact that the money's tied up, you know, when they invest.
Typically a 10-year commitment, right?
Typically a 10-year commitment, right. So that they require a premium of, and it's a rule of thumb, but it's 3%, what they call 300 basis points in the industry, 3%. Private equity has not met CalPERS benchmarks for the last 10 years, 10, 5, 3, you know, over, and not just 10 years, over sub-measurement periods within that time frame. So their own, and it's not by a little, it's by, again, hundreds of, you know, whole percentages. And again, an average of close to that 300 basis points or 3%. So their own measurements say they are not getting paid enough for the risk they are taking in private equity. And finance professors who've looked at what CalPERS is doing have said basically there are other strategies that, again, are risky, they involve leverage, that actually do offer similar returns. And CalPERS doesn't, now, whether they're actually better, you know, is open to question, but CalPERS doesn't even appear to have considered them.
Okay, so why do smart people with fiduciary responsibilities to manage that money why do they wind up going into bad deals with private equity?
Well, first thing, again, they're still, you know, what they call the, quote, absolute return, the not risk-adjusted return, still has been higher than CalPERS' portfolio average, generally speaking. So they can kind of rationalize it on that basis. Oh, well, we're still, but it's a rationalization. If you were sort of being honest about it, you'd say this is wrong. But, you know, a lot of it is that there's a self-preservation element. You know, CalPERS has a huge portfolio of this stuff. You know, it took them when they realized that, you know, they had a much smaller commitment to hedge funds. When CalPERS recognized, in fact, it was the first post I wrote on my blog, ironically, was about CalPERS in 2006. CalPERS was basically saying, well, we're not getting paid enough for risk in hedge funds. And, you know, I said at the time, gee, that means the obviously conclusion is that CalPERS should not be in hedge funds. And it took them 8 years to, you know, 8 years later to say that they weren't going to be in that strategy anymore. You know, it takes a, there's a lot of institutional inertia when you've got commitment to a strategy, and even more so in private equity, because CalPERS has just been so big in this business, and the private equity people are great at cultivating personal relationships with these firms, and they're great at selling hope. These people are just fantastically persuasive salesmen, and they walk in, you know, and when other strategies walk in, they talk, you know, very dry language. These guys come in, and they've got war stories about what they did with the companies and what rate returns they did. It's all sort of very seductive. And you do have the element, frankly, that these are huge political donors, and that the elected representatives, you know, now there's no direct conflict in California because private equity funds are not permitted to give donations, you know, to the treasurer or to the controller who sit on CalPERS board. But if anybody's thinking of running for higher office, they're not going to want to annoy private equity because they're big donors.
Right now, CalPERS and CalSTRS have a dropping funding level estimated by their chief financial officer to be between 73 and 75% of what they need to cover their obligations. Missed their investment return target last year, which was 7.5%. And that doesn't mean anybody's retirement fund's going to be hurting anytime soon. What it does mean is they will likely be increasing the amount of money they ask for from the public agencies whose employees they cover. And that means a bigger crunch on public budget. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about returns, right?
That's right. And, you know, and in fairness, all of these, you know, CalPERS and CalSTRS are in the same, you know, actually there are very many public pension funds that are in a much worse position than CalPERS and CalSTRS in terms of their funding. You know, all long-term investors, and this includes insurance companies as well, are very much caught in this post-crisis environment of the Fed keeping interest rates so low. You know, it used to be that public pension funds could make an adequate return by investing in safe things like bonds, you know, and then having stocks and other risky investments, you know, help pull their returns up. You know, now they're not earning anything remotely adequate on bonds, and they're under tremendous pressure to do what the term of art in finance is called reach for yield. You know, the Fed has basically been pushing all kinds of investors into riskier investments. You know, so you've got this conundrum that people aren't being paid enough for risk sort of anywhere. And private equity is just one of the more extreme examples.
All right. Let's bring some of our listeners in for questions. First on the line, we have Dan in San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning. Richard Blum is the husband of Senator Dianne Feinstein and sits on the University of California Board of Regents. I doubt he is knowledgeable in the field of education, yet CalPERS is investing a lot of money in his company. So I see that as a conflict of interest. Thank you.
All right. We'll take that as a comment, not a question. Move on to Matt and Topanga. Good morning, Matt.
Hi. As we all know, sunshine is the best disinfectant. As far as the difficult lawyerese, isn't there a stipulation of a translation that can be put into these, as it's like, you know what, I'd have an easier time reading German. What does this say to the lay person? And also, kind of a broader issue, and I know I've emailed you several times about this, Brian, and I hope you'll do the story eventually, about state-owned banks. Many of the stories I hear on this wonderful show have to do with shortage of funds. And we all know that state-owned banks fill their coffers like a car that generates its own fuel. Why should oligarchs steal this money that we the people own?
Well, let me answer that in two parts. The first is, unfortunately, there's a tendency for investment contracts to be legally dense, but I agree that private equity ones are extremely dense. To your point about sunshine, one of the things that's helped preserve the complexity of these agreements is that they, across the U.S., are the only contracts that are systematically hidden from public scrutiny. You know, in every other type of contract that state and local governments enter into can be obtained by FOIA. Private equity literally has gone around the country and either gotten legislation passed or favorable state attorney general opinions saying that these agreements can be kept secret, which is absurd. You know, so in fact, even though they're legally dense, if they were made public, you know, there are enough sort of smart people out there, there would be enough eyes on them that could help decompose them and, you know, and saber rattle more effectively. I've gotten my hands on 25 and put them up on my site. That sort of started in that direction, but it's still a very small subset of industry contracts. To your second point on state banks, we have written about them. There's only one example right now in the U.S., which is in North Dakota, which has been very successful. The one caveat on state banks is that there actually was a period in the U.S. where there were quite a lot of state banks. The problem is that they became vehicles for corruption. That was one of the reasons why they were shut down in most other states except for North Dakota, which apparently is able to run a, you know, clean enough government that they've kept their state bank clean. I mean, it's a great idea, but you just need to have, and it's been very successful for North Dakota, but you just really need to have very good checks and balances to make sure that it just doesn't become another kitty for state and local oligarchs.
All right, let's try to bring in one more caller before the clock runs out. And this, we've got Amina on the line in Daly City. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm in CalPERS, and I have the option to be in a 401k, neither of which I think, based on what you're saying, are particularly ethical options. So as an employee, what's one supposed to do?
I would actually say, despite the problems with CalPERS, you are better keeping your money in CalPERS because they, 401ks are notorious for having very high fees, many hidden fees. A lot of them do play tricks on the investors, like they, you know, for instance, if you want to move your money from one fund to another, they'll be very, very slow about it and keep now what they call float. You know, the value of them having your money and you not having it is a lot lower than it used to be, again, because of these super low interest rates. You know, CalPERS does have a lot more leverage and they do pay a lot less in fees. So I would say if you've got a choice between one or the other, CalPERS is still better than any retail option by a wide margin.
Okay. Smith, there's been an increasing push in California to use the leverage of CalPERS and CalSTRS to advance social agendas. The legislature has just passed a bill that is almost certain to be signed into law that will require them to ditch all their coal investments over time. Does investing through private equity firms compromise their ability to actually know what they're holding and divest when the state decides it wants to move away from something?
Well, yeah. Well, as I indicated, many of the private equity funds have invested in energy plays. I don't know how many of those are coal related, but you would have to think that there are some. And they can sell them on the secondary market. In theory, there's now more of a secondary market for private equity than there used to be. But, you know, whether they can get, if the fund stake is particularly large, they might not get, the risk is that they might not get a very good price. I mean, but the more general issue is that level of disclosure they typically do have. They do at least know, the investors are told the names of the companies they invest in. It's the more detailed financial disclosure that is spotty. On those companies,
like the internal financials of the companies.
The internal financials, right? They don't get the detailed financials. They will typically get some high level financial, you know, like some key ratios and key information, but they don't have access to the detailed financials, which is what you'd need to see all of the charges that the private equity firms are making against those companies. That's been one of the disturbing things that's been discovered, is that they've been taking at least some funds have been taking charges out of the portfolio companies that were not clearly authorized in the contracts. That's the part that's tantamount to stealing. That's where the charges of stealing come from.
Stealing from the companies, also from public coffers, because when they charge fees, they go on the company's expense ledgers.
That's
which
right.
Means
yes,
they come out of corporate income tax.
That's right. Correct. It's ultimately coming out of the investor's hide, even though it's, you know, on paper coming out of the portfolio, what they call portfolio companies, the companies that the investors have bought.
All right. That's all the time we have. Eve Smith, thank you so much.
Terrific. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Eve Smith is founder of the blog Naked Capitalism, author of the book Econed, How Unenlightened Self-Interest Undermined Democracy and Corrupted Capitalism. She has a multi-part series up at her website with video clips and documents she's gotten through public records requests. NakedCapitalism.com, we will link to it from the archive of this broadcast at KPFA.org. Also, thank you so much to everyone who wrote in about the special report we did yesterday on private health care services in the Alameda County Jail. Turns out that the company we were reporting on, Corizon, is owned by a private equity firm, Chicago-based Beacon Petty O'Keefe. And in fact, some of the people who work inside it say the problems really started when they got taken over by private equity. Well, that does it for today's show. Upfront is a production of the KPFA News Department. We're here weekday mornings at 7 a.m. Catch archives of the show at kpfa.org. Email us at upfront@kpfa.org. And all praise to the people who make the show happen. Eileen Alfandary, Linda Khoury, Sophie Becker, Ali Barclay, Kirsten Thomas. My name's Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Stay tuned for Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar coming up at 8 a.m.
KPFA, KPFB Berkeley, 88.1, KFCF Fresno.
We have reached a point, black and white, where all of the previous systems of communication have become unusable.
That is the powerful voice of James Baldwin, heard on KPFA in 1963. This fall, we plan on presenting powerful voices from our history and new voices that are speaking truth to power. This will be a drive to remember. Our fall fund drive begins September 15. It's our audio gift to you, some of the world's most brilliant thinkers who have graced the airwaves here at KPFA.
Which means when they stop your car for a taillight, it's not about a taillight. It's about being thrown back into jail, and when you run, you are shot in the back.
You know, what it is that women do, what it is that we bring. We give birth to everybody.
We kept our promise. No summer fun drive.
You're welcome.
So join us this fall as we present new voices and many of your favorite icons. Help us make this a fun drive.